Good morning. It is 10:03 a.m. We are here today, July 6, 2020, in the OPA Hearing Room, Suite 907 of the DNA Building in Hagatnik, Guam, for the formal hearing of OPA PA 19-010 and 20-001, Glide Path Marianas Operations, Inc. versus the Guam Power Authority. Presiding over the hearing today is Public Auditor Benjamin J.F. Cruz. For the record, also present from the Office of Public Accountability are Jarek Hernandez and Vince Duenas. Will appellant GlidePath please identify themselves and any institutional representatives present for the record?
Good morning, Mr. Public Auditor. My name is Joshua Walsh. I'm one of the attorneys working with the appellant GlidePath on this appeal. To my right is Joseph Rosano, and we're from the offices of Rosano, Walsh, and Torres. Institutional representative today is Mr. Peter Rube from GlidePath.
Good morning.
And online with the Teams page is Aaron Hazen.
Thank you. Will purchasing.
Good morning.
Will purchasing agency GPA please identify themselves and any institutional representatives present for the record?
Yes. Good morning, Mr. OBA. Graham Botha, GPA General Counsel, and Ms. Tracy Nagyako, Assistant General Manager for Administration for GPA. There are no other representatives on Teams.
Thank you. Will interested party NG Solar please identify themselves and any institutional representatives present for the record?
Good morning, Mr. Public Auditor. Johnson on behalf of NG Solar. Also with me is Amelia Areola, also on behalf of NG Solar. And as an institutional representative, we have Darren Mingo present here. Well, and online we have Mateo Leonetti.
Thank you. We may proceed.
Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. I guess the first thing we have to address is this motion on the expert witness. The motion to add the additional witness was yours.
So, Your Honor, we filed essentially two requests. One is we added an expert witness named Robert Charles. Mr. Charles will be testifying to nothing different than what's already being prepared. We're just splitting the testimony into two categories. No reports have been filed in this case, so there's no change in the testimony. No exchange of issues has been made in this case, so there's no change in issues. It's just an additional person from the same exact company of which we were going to submit previously. The other motion that we filed was, we think it would be better and faster if the experts could actually listen to the entire proceeding. So when it's their time to testify, they would have all of the benefit of what the witnesses have said, and we won't have to put up additional hypotheticals based on what the testimony was during the trial. In fact, they can just, you know, tell what they heard and make their presentations. In the event that that's not acceptable, alternatively, we would like to have at least the experts listen to the other experts. And that would be to solely assist the attorneys, really, to prepare for a cross-examination and make a determination of what's being said is true and correct. I mean, obviously, in a case like this where we're going to be talking about engineering concepts, I mean, the lawyers are clearly unprepared to, or at least I am, unprepared to understand every engineering function and whether an engineering term or an individual using an engineering term would be the same that I would understand it or would be something completely different or not relevant. So we would like to have at least the experts listen to the other experts. With respect to Mr. Charles, he's really not being produced late because ANGI actually never told us who their expert witness would be. So we never really found out who their expert would be until June, I think, 25th. And actually, to this day, I've never received a resume for the proposed expert. All I got was a LinkedIn page on June 25th. So we really, if anyone's prejudiced by the particular experts, it would be us, because we only had, you know, approximately, you know, 11 or 12 days to actually figure out who their expert was. We're not really objecting. We're just saying that if Mr. Charles isn't going to be allowed to go forward, then their expert shouldn't be allowed to go forward on the same basis. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Ayala, or?
Thank you, Mr. Public Auditor. On Thursday of last week, we received a number of filings from Glycott's attorneys. One was an amended witness list where they listed a 19th witness. 19. His name is Robert Charles, and he is being called as a supposed expert witness in this case. We had previously advised all the other parties that our expert witness would be from a group called Advisium. On June 24th, when we had the logistics meeting, we were still unaware about who was the expert witness for Glypath until they actually identified him to us, and that would be Vincent Mayone. Mr. Mayone has a one-page resume in their exhibits. After they identified Mr. Charles on Thursday, we did not receive his resume until after the close of business and after we had filed our motion to strike the amended witness list. His resume is 17 pages long. We never heard of this guy, don't know what he's about, don't know why he's here. Glypath is now saying today, he's just gonna say the same thing. Then why do we need him? That would be cumulative, it would be unnecessary, it would be duplicative. And so why do we need to have him? What it appears to us is that on Thursday morning, Glypath and its counsel woke up and said, wow, we got an OPA hearing on Monday. We got to present some evidence. Gee, we better get a second expert witness, and we better have the expert witness listen to all the other experts, especially our clients and what they're going to say, and we better have some nice charts, like the NG charts that were produced in their exhibit list. So on Friday night, we received something called demonstrative aids, 4 pages of a color chart that was prepared by Glypath. We had never seen it before, wasn't ever introduced in evidence, wasn't in any of the trial briefs, wasn't even referred to in their trial briefs. So what we have is we have Glypath at the last minute scrambling to try to make their case before the public auditor, and we're left in the lurch trying to figure out how to oppose these last minute filings. Now, Mr. Charles has an extensive resume. I don't know what he's about, but if he's going to testify basically to the same thing that their other expert is going to testify, or to the same thing that their lay witnesses are going to testify, his testimony is unnecessary and it's cumulative. And the amended witness list should be stricken. He should not be allowed to testify, not at this late date. You know, we listed all of our witnesses on March 13th in compliance with this public auditor's scheduling order. The scheduling order and the OPA rules of procedure are there for a reason. They're to level the playing field for all of the parties and all of their counsel. When the public auditor says, file your exhibit list, your witness list, and your other filings on a particular day, that's when you should file it. And that's what we did. We filed our exhibit list, our witness list, etc. on March 13th. Now, at the last minute, literally the eve of the hearing, because Friday was a holiday, we're hearing about a new second expert witness. It's extremely unfair and it's extremely prejudicial to us, because our entire case, the presentation of our case, is based upon the witnesses that they had listed. I would also note that they listed numerous witnesses from a company called Mott McDonnell. We thought they were going to be the expert witnesses. We didn't learn who their actual expert witness was until June 24th, when they told us it was Vince Mayone. In terms of the demonstrative aids, we filed a motion to strike this morning because we only received it Friday night from GPA's counsel. It's a color, 4 pages of a color graph.
When was that filed? I didn't see that over the weekend.
I filed this morning, the motion to strike. Ms. Public, may I approach?
The demonstrative aids have not been filed. They were simply just, rather than draw on a board, we prepped some graphics. But
this is our motion to strike. We received this on Friday evening. Yes, over the holiday. They claim that these are demonstrative aids. But in our view, these are in opposition to the exhibits that Angie filed. And I would also note an objection based on relevance and materiality. They have page 2 of their chart, which refers to the Denton Solar Project. That project is not at issue here. It's irrelevant and it's material. Any discussion relating to that project, even in terms of how it compares to the project here, is irrelevant and should be excluded. The next issue is that they want to have their experts listen to the other lay witnesses' testimony. We believe that that is unfounded and that their motion should be denied. They cite at length one rules of evidence, rule 615. As Mr. Public Auditor knows, the rules of evidence do not apply here in Guam in this proceeding. Everything should be informal, but at the same time, the rules are to be construed in order to have this informal hearing as expeditious and as non-duplicative and non-cumulative as possible. In this case, they want their experts to listen to their prior witnesses' testimony and other lay witnesses' testimony, and it's unnecessary. Glytas' primary claim in this case is that there was a limitation on the megawatt peak capacity of the PV module system. Our contention and GPA's contention is there is no such limitation. It doesn't exist in the IFB and it doesn't exist in the amendments. Because their claim is solely related to the IFB and its amendments, you don't need an expert witness to listen to the other witness's testimony. Their witnesses are going to say, oh, it's in there. And our witnesses are going to say, no, it's not in there. So what's the point? Their expert witness can only look at the IFB and the amendments to say it's in there or it's not. That's the only issue here. We're going to hear a lot of other different issues that they're raising, you know, as these smoke screens, but the bottom line is that's the only issue in this case. That's all I have, Mr. Public Auditor, unless you have questions.
Thank you. So there really is several things that we need to... A motion to strike the demonstrative. Do you wish to speak on it?
No.
That's correct.
It's really fairly elementary. It might help me in my decision. So, just this demonstrative aid, as long as we don't start a printing press on that site and start sending a whole series.
And that was not our intention. In fact, we probably wouldn't even enter these into evidence. They're just to help along with the examination of at least Mr. Rude. And so that's the only reason we thought they would be helpful to you.
But Mr. Public Auditor, the scheduling order stated that the exhibits that were to be filed on March 13 included any exhibits that are to be used in examination of witnesses. This was not provided. We provided all of our experts that were going to be used to examine them on our witnesses. The scheduling order says right there in black and white.
Well, the rules of evidence don't necessarily apply. Of course, the orders of the OPA apply. But again, the exhibit is simply demonstrative. I mean, you could simply write it up on a board. This is just making it easier for everyone to see. And I agree. I mean, you have to follow the orders, and that's exactly why we feel that Anji should have no expert witness at this trial, because they never told us who their expert witness was going to be. When I went to the LinkedIn page, and you can see in my declaration that I got on June 25th, I've still never received a resume, so I'm assuming that their expert has no resume. There's 31,000 people who work at Worley Parsons. So, and I just got that by clicking on the Worley Parsons link on the Avisian LinkedIn page that I got. So, you know, we didn't complain about that at all. we just simply, you know, let it go, and we were told on the 25th. But if the hard line is going to be you follow the order or you don't follow the order, then they didn't follow the order. They never told us who their witness was going to be, and they never provided his resume. So we have no idea who he is. But anyway, with respect to the demonstrative exhibits, they're just helpful, and I think they'll be used in Mr. Rude's examination, and they'll be helpful to the OPS.
Okay. How about the listening? Do you wish to expand on your position on the listening?
On the expert witness?
Yes.
Yes. So we are not required to put in a resume for any of the expert witnesses, but we did advise everyone that our expert witness was coming from a group called Ephesian. We did not know who our expert witness was going to be until only recently, because we did not know who their expert witnesses were going to be either. They told us on June 25th that their expert was going to be Vince Mahone. Again, they have 19 witnesses. I mean, they're arguing pretty much the same thing that we are arguing, which is that they are prejudiced, and we are prejudiced, but they had 19 witnesses, several of them from a company called Mott McDonald. We did not know which one of those witnesses was going to be the expert until June 24th or 25th when we had the logistics meeting. And so even then, we didn't know who the expert witness was. When we told them that our expert witness was Richard Avellini, we told them, I had assumed that I was going to get the resume over to him when he asked for it. I completely forgot.
On the issue of whether or not they're going to be able to watch these proceedings is what I'm interested in.
Oh, okay. We object to that, Your Honor, primarily because of the... Well, we were doing the equipment on the facilities here. You'll see that my associate, Bucky Brennan, is here in the back. He has set up all the equipment on the last two logistics meetings. We had some difficulties, some feedback and noise with a number of people being able to get online. And so my biggest concern is we're going to lose people, we're going to lose the connection, or we're going to have feedback and noise. And so I don't think it's really necessary for an expert witness to listen to all the testimony. Here, in addition to my other reasons, which is that it's not really necessary for expert witnesses to hear all of the testimony in this case. It's really a question about what's in the IFP and the amendments. That's what the claim is all about. And then the third issue has to relate to the expert witness itself. You know, they're going to be calling two expert witnesses, one that we never heard of and one that was never listed on the exhibit list.
Okay.
Your Honor, just in response, Mr. Mahone has been on the exhibit list as number 10 since March 13th, 2020. So he's always been on the exhibit list the entire time. Or I'm sorry, on the witness list the entire time. And with respect to the issue of feedback, I mean, that's not really a fair reason not to allow the experts to have the ability to listen to the witnesses. I mean, that's just a failing of technology. If the technology doesn't support the platform, that's not a reason to prejudice the parties or a reason to prejudice the OPA, because the experts will be able to have already had the benefit of all the testimony. And it's not just what are the technical requirements of what is written in the book, but it's also what did GPA believe. I mean, we're going to find out what GPA believed they meant when they wrote the IFB, when they wrote the amendments. So we're going to have new evidence that's never been briefed and never been presented, and only going to be presented through the testimony of witnesses at GPA. So instead of them gathering the evidence during the day and creating hypotheticals for all the experts, they'll already know, and it will be faster and helpful, I think, to the OPA to have that. But certainly listening to the other experts is imperative, because I won't be able to tell if either GPA's expert or Hanji's expert is giving me true engineering capabilities, because I certainly don't know what engineering capabilities are. And I think it's pretty common in all court cases that experts are allowed to listen to other experts so they can draw their opinions. I mean, generally we have reports that get given to either side. Here, there's no reports at all.
May I just ask for a clarification? So is Glycraft intending to call their expert witness at the conclusion of all the evidence or at the conclusion of your case today?
We were planning on calling ours at the conclusion of our case, but we may call them again as a rebuttal depending on what it is that the experts say, but certainly I would need my expert to at least help me to determine, you know, I mean, obviously their expert's going to testify last, so they're going to have the benefit of the entire proceeding, and I at least need my expert to assist me in the cross-examination of their expert.
Okay. As to this demonstrative exhibit, I have no problem in receiving it. All right, so the motion to strike this is denied. As to the additional expert being provided by GlidePath, I will allow it. As to the listening, I will not. Okay.
Just briefly on that, I will probably then be sending a name to Mr. Hernandez for the second person who, non-testifying guest, to use that second spot. But I'll send that to Mr. Hernandez at our first break. Thank you, Mr. Public Auditor.
Thank you,
Mr. Public Auditor. Okay. Ready to proceed?
Yes, Mr. Public Auditor. I prepared a short opening. I don't know if the other parties feel the same way, but if a short opening is useful to the Public Auditor, I'm prepared to make one.
Please.
Good morning, Mr. Public Auditor. I'm going to be directed to the point. This is a procurement appeal involving $200 million in solar energy that has been brought before you because the procuring agency, in selecting an awardee, did not hold the certain important technical requirements that were set down in the IFB. This is what we're going to show you over the course of this appeal. We're going to show you the GPA set about in this IFB to procure two solar project sites capped at 30 megawatts a site. GPA set about in this IFB to add batteries to the solar sites, and that the batteries, the energy storage systems, the ESSs as you'll hear, those batteries were also capped at 30 megawatts. We're going to show you that all the bidders recognize those caps. We will show you how GPA, well over a year after the IFB was first issued, set an amendment down that demanded that the 30 megawatt cap be no more than 145% of the installed solar capacity on the site. A formula in that amendment that created a requirement that the installed arrays be no more than 20.7 megawatts, if you do the math. We will show you how GPA confirmed that 20 megawatt size in numerous clarifications provided to offerers. We're going to show you that there is no dispute that ANGI has installed more than 20.7 megawatts of panels on the site, installed on the site more than that limit. And we will explain to you how that provided a pricing advantage to ANGI, the awardee, that meant that GlidePath's price proposal could not effectively be measured against ANGI's price proposal. The result of this has been a flawed procurement where the people of Guam, people that are currently facing and staring down the potential disconnection of power because of the expensive nature of power on this island, people that have faced historically expensive prices of power on this island, how they are being provided a new power plant with this procurement where the prices offered by bidders could not be compared in a meaningful way because meaningful specifications, the 20.7 megawatt cap, have been ignored by the agency. Guam procurement law exists in part to assure that there is increased public confidence in our procurement. That's what the people of Guam expect. Most Guamanians, most of us, I'd say even most of us in this room, don't have daily interaction with procured police cars or procured ambulances or GSA procured toilet paper or thankfully even procured ventilators at an ICU in this day and age. Thankfully, we don't have those interactions. However, all of us, including those of us that are worried about the Teams page or the power coming out of the wall, all of us have daily interaction and reliance upon procured power. We need to make sure that there is public confidence in the price of that procured power, especially when we're talking about $200 million worth of procured power over the next decade. This procurement failed on that fundamental point. And this is why glide paths of fuel should be sustained. Thank you, Mr. Public Auditor.
Thank you, Public Auditor. At least we agree on one thing, and that is that the two sites were in fact capped at 30 megawatts, and that is due to the restriction on the transmission line and the GPA system. What is also clear is that glide paths is the only one that had trouble with the specifications in this matter. We had five bidders. Five competent bidders, and I'm sure as GlidePath will tell you that their organization has done, you know, numerous solar and wind projects and all the rest of that, and they're experts. So it's very interesting to find out that they're the only ones that had this artificial, what they call it, 20.7 megawatt cap on the solar arrays. That simply doesn't exist anywhere in the procurement. Nowhere in the procurement. Okay, I challenge them to find anything. They can say that they misinterpreted the specs, as they said in the original thing. Maybe they did misinterpret it, but funny, the other four didn't misinterpret it, and of course we'll be happy to show that. You know, the entire procurement process went from November 28th to June 3rd, roughly 18 months. There were, as you'll see, basically two amendments that had a lot of questions in them, Amendment 8 and Amendment 17, and I think we've highlighted those in our brief, but we'll certainly go over them with the testimony of the parties. The parties, including GlidePath, asked numerous questions, and numerous responses were given by the GPA procurement folks. There was no flawed procurement here. The bottom line is that GlidePath either misinterpreted whatever, and if you look at their bid, they're not even in the range of what NG proposed to us, okay? So if we want to talk flawed procurement, it would be a failure on the part of GPA to award to NG, which is what they're asking, okay? The price is 35-40% higher than what NG proposed. There's nothing wrong with NG. I don't think GlidePath has ever said that NG is not responsible, responsive bidder. None of that. Because of course they can't, because there's no evidence to that. All they're saying is that, well, if you disagree with their interpretation that awarded to GlidePath and that they can't be compared together, that's nonsense. Okay, there's an abstract that we'll go over. There was a scoring sheet that you had to put your proposals there, the megawatts that you're going to put in, the price for each site. There were different prices for different sites because of the difficulty, perhaps, and it appears that for almost all the bidders, Naval Base Guam was a little more expensive. We attribute that to difficulty in accessing the base and all the rest of it. So there is a basis for the different prices and the different megawatts that were put out by all the folks. We would certainly be happy to go over the different parts of both the invitation for bid from the very beginning, and that there is, in fact, no such gap. And the other four bidders did not find any such gap, and of course their sites reflected that. We believe the procurement code is clear. GPA must award to the lowest responsive bidder, and those responsive bidders, those that submitted a bid which conforms in all material respects to the IFP. The other additional thing that GlidePath has asked for is to rebid. It is GPA's position, as it has been with other cases, that it would be manifestly unfair to allow for a rebid, as canceling the proposed award is unfair to the bidding process, and specifically to the successful bidder, NG. With that, Your Honor, we would request that you deny the appeal and uphold the award to NG.
Thank you.
Mr. Public Auditor, I'm Marcel Johnson, and Anita Ariola represent NG Solar here. At the heart of this matter, really, is GlidePath's claim that the IFB limited the maximum, as Mr. Walsh stated, solar array of the PV panels installed at each one of these two sites to a number that is 20.7 megawatt peak. GlidePath claims that NG exceeded GlidePath's alleged limitation in this IFB. We intend to show that no such limit existed in this invitation for bid. We intend to show that GlidePath only believed such a limitation existed because of their lack of experience with these types of PV plus ESS systems. And we intend to show that the bids submitted by the other bidders show that none of the other bidders believe that such a limit existed either. To do this, we intend to call several witnesses. They will touch on three main points. First, that NG has years of experience in designing, building, and operating PV plus ESS systems. In fact, right now, NG has 16 existing PV plus ESS systems operating in islands and islanded areas. Islanded areas, we mean areas that are not connected to large electrical grids. For instance, if you were working in the desert, that would be an islanded area. It has 16 of these existing PV plus ESS systems operating in islands and islanded areas throughout the world. It has experience in this field. Second, we intend to show that NG met the requirements of this invitation for bid that are related to this appeal. Third, we intend to show that NG was the lowest bidder, submitting a bid that was 29% lower in terms of dollars per kilowatt hour than the second lowest bidder, who was ADS on Glidepath. And there's one last point that I would like to ask you, Mr. Public Auditor, to pay attention to during the course of this procurement hearing. And if I may, I'd like to point to one of the slides that we circulated earlier with our exhibit. And this is with respect to one term that is very specific to the invitation for bid, and that is the term PV charging system. I'd like you to pay attention to the terms that people use to describe this phrase, because this phrase is specifically used by GPA in its invitation for bid. Now, as Mr. Walsh said, he changed this term a little bit. He said PV array or solar PV array. This is a solar PV array here. We intend to show that the requirement number two, also known as the 145% requirement as referred to it by Glidepath, is a limitation on the PV charging system. Our witnesses will explain that the term PV charging system is not the same as a PV panel or a solar array. And that the term PV charging system cannot be used or measured in terms of megawatt peak, which is used specifically to refer to the megawatt peak of a PV solar array, not anything else. The PV panels alone provide the potential to charge a battery. They do not provide the actual charge that goes into a battery. A DC-DC converter is needed in order to provide that charge to the battery. An analogy that we will bring up during the course of this hearing is that of a basin, a pump, and a tank. Water in a basin is useless to the tank unless there is a pump to pump that energy into the tank. So please, during this hearing, please pay particular attention to this distinction between PV charging system, solar array, and PV panels. To end, we believe that the evidence this hearing will show that NG was the lowest bidder, that NG was an undeniably responsible bidder, given its years of experience in this field, and that NG's bid met the requirements set forth in the invitation for bid. And lastly, that Glidepath's appeal should be denied so the GPA can proceed with its award to NG. Thank you.
Sorry, Yogi, did you wish to add anything?
No.
Okay.
We're prepared to call the first witness, but if we could take a short break, we're going to set up a little easel.
Please give a short recess.
We're off the record at 10:37 a.m. We're back on the record at 10:44 a.m.
Appellant calls Jennifer Simlon.
Could you please raise your right hand? Please state your name for the record.
Do
you solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Okay. Thank you.
Good morning,
Ms. Savon.
How are you?
Okay.
My name is Joe Rosano, and I'm from Glidepath in this matter. Mr. Public Auditor, just since we were off the record and we weren't recording when we had the request from Ken Flores at TG Engineering, did you want to put that on the record that there was a colloquy regarding him trying to come in and
fine.
Okay, and so he requested to come in, and there was a colloquy about whether or not he assisted ONG with preparation of bid. They respectfully answered that question yes, and the public auditor decided that Mr. Flores should not be needed for the record.
Yeah, I'm just concerned. I don't want to overtax any system, if that's part of the concern. I want to protect it. He can listen to it later when you put it online.
Okay. Ms. Sablon, can you please state your name and spell it for the record?
Jennifer Sablon, J-E-N-N-I-F-E-R, Sablon, S-A-B-L-A-N.
And where do you work?
I work with Guam Power Authority.
And in what division?
I'm the manager of the Strategic Planning and Operations Research Division.
And are you an engineer?
Yes, I am.
And how long have you been an engineer?
I graduated in 94 and got my registration and license in 2010.
How long have you worked at GPA?
Over 25 years.
Where else have you worked previous to GPA?
GPA.
GPA, okay. Any other utilities or?
None.
What are your responsibilities on like a daily basis?
Well, my section is kind of a new project type of section. So we handle renewables, new power plant procurement, we handle fuels procurement and contracting. We've done smart grid in our section. We do demand side management. That's most of the stuff that we do.
So you're keeping pretty busy then?
Yes.
The IFB that we're talking about today, you're familiar with it,
yes,
is that correct? And what was your involvement with the IFB in the preparation of it?
I was pretty involved with that, yes.
Okay, and what kind of things did you do to help prepare it?
Pretty much put it together. It was part of a previous bid, but it got amended over time due to changes that we found in our system.
When you say previous bids, is that because it evolved itself out of the phase one and phase two,
yes,
renewables program?
Yes.
Okay. So when you went to put together the phase three IFP, were you taking portions of the materials from phase one and phase two and using them for the phase three IFP?
Mostly phase two, because it's already been evolved by then. Yes.
Mostly phase two.
But it did get amended.
You're saying the phase three got amended many times?
It got amended, yes, from the phase two original.
Okay. And the phase three bid was a multi-step bid, is that correct?
Yes.
And what were the steps?
The first step is qualification based on the technical proposal, and then the second step would be based on price.
And why does GPA like to use a multi-step bid?
To ensure that the bidders are qualified and meet the requirements that we set out.
I'll just ask you to identify the bid. If there's a huge binder in front of you, the white one, right?
There's two volumes.
Oh, okay. So maybe in volume one, it's exhibit 1-004. So there's a bait stamp number on the very bottom on the, okay. So I just want to make sure that you identify that as the IFB. Is that correct?
Yes. Part of it, yes.
I'm so
part
sorry.
The original part, right? The original issued IFB.
Yes. I guess you start on one, but that's volume one, yes.
Yeah, volume one. Okay, thank you. What are the difference in the steps you described, the technical step, and then what did you call the second step?
It's a price evaluation for the second step.
Okay. What's the difference between the two steps?
Okay, I mentioned the first step is to make sure that the parties meet certain requirements that we'd like to see, so that we're just not evaluating price, but we're ensuring that we're getting the expertise and the technical requirements that we've asked for.
Okay. So in that technical side, then is there a review process that goes along with that?
There is.
Okay. And can you describe that process for me?
So So we received technical proposals, and when I say we, there's a committee that's been established, and everybody reviews it, and there's a scoring mechanism that breaks down different areas of the proposal that we'd like to evaluate. And there's a score to that, and we set minimum requirements for proposals to pass.
In that scoring sheet, or the scoring mechanism, does that have a list of the requirements for the evaluators?
Yes, it does.
Now, in the IFB, the original one that was issued volume one, what exactly is GPA procuring?
Energy.
And how many megawatts, and is it AC or DC?
Well, we receive energy at the interconnection point, which is directly into our system. And we don't specify an energy amount, that's the bidder's guarantee.
And in the scoring sheet, do you recall what the requirements were for the purchasing of the kilowatt hours?
Well, the requirements were it had to be on the Navy site as identified. It needed to interconnect onto a 34.5 kV system. The PV had to be behind an ESS for the purpose of that energy to be stored and delivered outside of the production period, because we couldn't take it during the day. And we would pay for the energy received metered at that interconnection point.
And those are contained in the original IFB that we were talking about.
That's the main requirement.
Was there a list of the requirements in the IFB, like a sheet where you could go and see what all the requirements were?
There was a summary and I think part of the technical portion of what we were expecting from them.
Was it a requirement that the system contained be DC coupled?
There was a requirement for the PV system to be behind the ESS. And there was reasons for that because of system stability on our side. So there was no direct PV connection to the grid.
Other than yourself, I mean, this is a very large procurement. Who else assisted you with preparing the IFB?
There was a couple people in my section, as well as the assistant general manager of engineering technical service. We were transitioning. I became sport manager in 2017. So this was a document that was developed over time. And then we hired a consultant to assist with the energy storage characteristics.
And who is the assistant?
John.
Is he like a has an engineering firm or a consulting firm?
John Cruz, So there are several people in my section. Mr. Cruz was one of them. He, like I said, he transitioned, became manager while this was all kind of coming together. So he was the former manager. And then we hired Dave Burlingame from EPS to help with the development of the energy storage characteristics. These are actually our stability.
Do you recall what portions of the IFB that he prepared?
Mainly focusing on the interconnection, the ESS and the way it was to be interconnected into our system.
Did you communicate with Mr. Burlingame by email, or did he come to Guam?
He's been to Guam. He's done several stability studies. He did our system impact studies for our phase two. And he's also done large renewable integration studies for the system.
When the IFB was amended, did he have input into those amendments?
Yes, actually, he developed that early on, but we were waiting for some input from Navy to address some of the lease requirements for the bid.
And I asked you earlier, and I didn't allow you to answer the question, but did you communicate with him by email?
We've emailed, and we've had meetings with him in person. I don't exactly know when, but he's come to talk.
And when he assisted with putting together the amendments or the answers to the amendments, is there a communication between you and him or others via email?
I know he's put together the initial ESS bid. I don't know during the rest of the amendments, but most of the time it was email or telecom.
Do you have all those emails?
I think I have some, at least when we put together an initial package.
Now, were the bidders for the IFB allowed to ask questions, you know, like a question and answer period?
There was an initial period for question and answers, and then as we issued changes or amendments, we allowed for clarifications.
And was that sort of the process? There was one section where you would have generalized questions, and then that ended at a certain period?
Yeah, because it helps us to catch up with, you know, we had hundreds of questions.
Sure. Okay. So do you recall at what point in the process that no more new questions could be answered, just clarifying questions?
I know there's a schedule. I don't know.
Okay.
So bidders were advised as to when that would end. But like I said, every time we issue an amendment, we allow clarification if that date was passed.
I see. Do you recall, after the initial set of questions, how long it took GPA to answer the questions?
It did take some time because this wasn't just a GPA bid. We were partnering with Navy. So some of the questions were specific to things that we could not answer. So we had to wait for Navy.
Now, I know that the IFB, when you issue it, requires CCU approval. Is that correct?
It does initially, I think, for the internet
office. Okay. What about amendments to the IFB? Do they require CCU approval? When an amendment is going to be issued, changing the bid or clarifying the bid, who makes the decision to issue the amendment?
Overall, it becomes the general manager's decision to make that change, but it gets prompted either through the questions or through something that may have happened within the authority.
So maybe your office says, well, we should maybe amend something, and then you bring it to the attention of the general manager, or is that the process?
Like I said, it could have been generated through the questions that were prompted. So, I mean, I don't know that we just make change unless something triggers it.
But the general manager's not reading all of these questions and making a decision on his own, right?
I'm hoping he is, but I can't see what the general manager does.
Okay. Fair enough. When you decide to issue an amendment, who sits down and writes it?
There could be other parties that do it. I mean, it's not just me. Some people could help develop that response. I mean, maybe it provides their own response, but just put it on a different paper, right?
Right. Okay. And then you said the general manager approves them.
Mm-hmm.
And in this IFB, there were amendments. Is that correct?
There were several.
Do you remember how many?
It was more than 17.
More than 20?
Probably. I can't recall.
Do you recall Amendment 13?
I believe that was the one where we issued the DSS.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to turn the paper binder to 2-159.
Mm-hmm.
attachment B to amendment 13?
It looks like it is, yes.
How many megawatts per site? So you had, you said you had the Navy site, you had the South Wind site. How many megawatts is each project per site?
You know, we estimated it that it would be about 20 or so. I think it was a little less based on the first original.
How did you estimate that?
You know, we're not, we, GPA, are not PV designers, but we've worked with, we've had another contract that had a project, so we were basing it off of what they were able to put out on their project.
Are you familiar with the term PV?
Yes.
And can you tell me what it is?
Photovoltaic.
Okay, and is a PV module, are you familiar with that term?
Yes.
Is a PV module the same as a solar panel?
I would say so, yes.
And the panels, the solar panels, they're rated in watts, is that correct?
Yes.
So if I had, say, 10 panels that were rated at 300 watts per panel, and I wanted to install that on my roof, I would have an aggregate rating of about 3,000 watts. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that again?
Yeah, so if I had 10 panels, that's all I could afford, and I wanted to put them on my roof, and they're all rated at 300 watts. If I aggregated that together, I'd have 3,000 watts, right?
Mm-hmm.
And 3,000 watts would be 3 kilowatts. So essentially, we're all here today to talk about this 145% requirement. And the requirement, as I understand it, establishes the relationship between PV capacity and the storage system. Is that correct?
That was to, yes, to establish a relationship between the two. But for the purpose of designing output for a shorter period of time than it would have been storing the energy.
Your Honor, may I approach the... So if I installed that 3 kilowatt system on my roof, that would be my capacity, correct?
That would be the PV capacity.
So, if I had a capacity of 10 megawatts to go in accordance with this 145% requirement, if I had 10 megawatts, then that means my minimum ESS would be 14.5, is that right? So I'm,
if you're using that calculation, 145 of 10 is 14.5.
Okay. So that would be multiplying it by 145%, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Have you ever seen GPA's hearing brief that was filed in this case?
Yes, I did.
You have seen it? Ask if you've ever seen this document. And I represent that's GPA's hearing brief that was filed.
I've seen this.
So in that hearing brief, on page 5, you see a chart?
Page
5? It's on page 5, yes. It's like a chart at the top, and it talks about different bidders, and breaks it into the South Finnegan site and the Navy site. You see that?
Mm-hmm.
So, in the brief, what is GlidePath's capacity, PV capacity, listed in the brief that GPA filed? I'll just put a little GP for GlidePath. Just for the building, let's just do the South Fitigain site.
So, for, what did you want, the solar? The PV?
Yes, the PV megawatts.
20.6 megawatts.
20.6. And how about for Hanwha KEPCO?
21.06.
And how about AES?
23.58.
And Exelio?
24.97.
You said 24.97, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. And how about for Anju?
26.47.
Okay. Now, last night I went and did the math of multiplying these numbers times the 145%. And I came up with GlidePath having a minimum ESS of 29.87. And Hanwha KEPCO, I got 31.32.
Mm-hmm.
And for AES, I got 34.19. For Exelio, I got 36.20. And for Anji, I got 38.38. Okay. Now, I think earlier you told me that each site was rated for 20 megawatts.
That was estimated at the beginning.
Okay. Was there ever a time where the parties were informed that each site could support 30 megawatts?
No, but there was questions regarding what they could bid on, and we said there's no minimum, so we addressed that.
But was there a maximum?
There's a maximum for the point of interconnection.
And what was that?
30 megawatts.
30 megawatts. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in the brief also it says what the ESS sizes were.
Mm-hmm.
You see that?
Yes, I do.
So for GlidePath, what was the offer of the ESS size in their proposal?
For the South Bend is 30 megawatts.
All right. And how about Hanwha KEPCO?
30 megawatts.
30 megawatts. And how about for AES?
25.
And for Exelio?
14.
And how about for Anji?
30 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you would agree that only GlidePath is less than 30. Is that correct?
Based on
your calculation, yeah. Okay. On the next page of your binder, 2-160. Mm-hmm. top of the page in the introduction section. Can you just read that to yourself briefly? Right. Okay. In the introduction section, it's telling the bidders that they're going to be evaluated on the requirements that they see below. Is that correct? And that if there's any difference between the IFB document and this particular amendment, that this amendment will hold true.
At this time, yes?
At this time, right, correct, of course. Turn to 2-027. Many zeros and then a 27. Oh, well, you know, before that, you had said at that time, was there any other amendment that changed Amendment 13?
There were some clarifications that came out after that addressed some of these things.
Okay. Sure, so clarifications, but not changes to that.
Those would be amendments, too. They're in amendments. They're actually amendments with clarifications. So they are amendments to the bid.
Before you go to 2-27, then let's go to 5-00-1. Oh, maybe it's in volume. It's probably in volume 2. Yes. So do you recognize that document?
It looks like an amendment for this bid.
Okay. And do you think it's Amendment 17?
It says it, yes.
Okay. And at the top, does it have a similar introduction section like Amendment 13 had? Does it have an introduction section?
It says this is the response to clarification entries, yes.
Okay. Does it have the same warning on the top that you're going to be evaluated on your ability to adhere to these requirements? And does it say that if in fact there's a difference between the IFB and this amendment holds true?
It doesn't say that.
Okay, now let's go to 2-27. Sorry to make you. On 2-27, I think there was a question number 21 that was asked, I think, by a company called Recurrent. Do you see it on that page, or is it
21? Yes, I
do see it. And could you read the question?
Please confirm that the 30 megawatt export limit is a per interconnection limit. For example, bidders will be permitted to propose two systems, one at South End, one at Eagle Base, that exports 20 megawatt AC at each interconnection.
And what was GPA's answer to that?
The 30, you want me to read it?
Yes, please.
Okay. The 30 megawatt output limit is a per location limit. For instance, the summation of the output of the naval base bomb sites cannot exceed 30 megawatt AC. The summation of the South Venegas sites cannot exceed 30 megawatts. The ESS should be able to provide up to 30 megawatt AC output in aggregate for each interconnection. Naval Base Guam and South Bend was a desired duration as commanded by GPA through GPU's data AGC or scheduled by the GPU and ESS operator. Nominal operation is 20 milliwatt DC.
What does nominal mean?
I guess for this it would be if your PV was 20 megawatt DC. You're still restricted at the interconnection.
I don't understand your question, and also don't guess. If you don't know what it means, then
I'm not
tell
sure
us.
What it means at this point.
Okay. You didn't write this particular answer.
Not that one.
You know who did?
That language was from somebody else.
Do you know who that human was?
I believe that might have been John Pierce.
So as you sit here today, you don't know what nominal.
Yeah, I don't know what it's referring to right now.
So if you go back to then 5-0002, and there should be a section 1.1.1C. Do you see that? Three-part question, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. And then there's an answer from GPA. So just focusing on the section that GPA answered regarding nominal, can you read that section?
Nominal was referenced to an estimated average installed PV capacity for each site. Energy system capability must allow dispatch of each system from zero dispatched to full load up to 30 megawatt AC interconnection capacity.
So it ties the term nominal to PV capacity. Is that correct?
Well, it's a reference to an estimated average there, yes.
She said this. Have you reviewed Angie's proposal? Have you ever seen it?
I did.
When GPA procures the power, like in this ISP, do they expect to receive all the power that's generated from the project?
Whatever's delivered from the project at the interconnection point, yes.
If you move to 3- many zeros and an 11.
Three,
it might be the first binder. Second binder.
Yes, sorry, what is the page?
3-0000. Recognize that page as a portion of Angie's proposal?
It looks like it could be, yes.
Okay. And towards the bottom of it, section 1.1, it has two different sections of their project. The PV plant, do you see that?
Yes.
And what's the megawatts on that PV plant?
It looks like 2647, but it's a little blurry, so it's hard to make sense.
Okay. And then the second portion is BESS portion, is that right?
Yes.
And I'll represent to you that if you move to 4-4-0011, it'll be the same exact representation with respect to a different site.
Same concept,
okay, thank you. Now, why would GPA contact a bidder after submission of their bid?
We would do it if there were issues with the bid that was submitted, whether it was unclear, or there may be some, if the bidder indicated that their proposal had an exception or something like that.
Okay. So legitimate reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah. Were bidders contacted after their submission in this particular IFB?
I think there was some clarifications made for the technical evaluation.
Okay. Do you know who?
I can't remember all of them.
Okay.
There was several.
Do you remember any?
I don't know. I know there was some that were.
Okay.
I just don't know who.
And as a result of those contacts, did GPA allow anybody to fix or clarify their bid or change something?
I don't know that we, I gotta look for that.
Okay. Do you recall if there were two projects that were AC coupled? One by Exelio and one by Hanwha Kepco?
I don't recall.
Who would be better to answer these questions?
You know, it's been some time. I was part of the evaluation committee, but I can't remember everything. That was almost a year ago.
Okay. So is there anyone else that I could call to talk to?
It would be those in the committee.
Okay. Do you recall if GPA allowed anybody to redesign their project?
I don't believe we do. I think we clarified whether they're system was it either AC, the ESS AC, or that everything is behind the ESS.
Do you remember AES building their panels on top of the GWA sewer line? Do you recall that as part of the evaluation committee?
I don't know that. I do. Sorry, I don't.
That's okay. Well, anyway, I mean, you would let people fix their bids because you'd want to get the most confident and the most competitive bids, right?
Well, we want to make sure that what we're reading is what we're reading was clear. So we didn't want to take any chances on that.
I mean, that's what's best for the rate payer, right?
Well, to make sure that they're not putting in a bid based on assumption, right?
I have one more exhibit I want to show you. It's part of the procurement record, but it's not in our exhibit binder. It's page 4168 of 12444. Mr. Bellagotter, may I approach? Just for the party's knowledge, this is a page from GlidePath. Well, I'll show it to everybody. It's a page from GlidePath's bid submission. I'll just ask if you've ever seen that document.
Yeah, it was part of it, probably.
Correct, it was. And on the very last paragraph, it says bid size. Do you see that? What's it saying to GPA?
They're willing to consider providing additional project configuration and siting options should they be desired by GPA.
What does the last sentence say?
GlidePath believes that should GPA be able to reevaluate these requirements, increased project sizing will ultimately be beneficial to the repairs to provide lower cost energy than is currently possible with a project that fully complies with the IFP requirements.
Did GPA ever ask GlidePath to redo or fix their bid?
No.
Was GlidePath ever contacted by GPA ever after the submission?
Not for that. We did not do that.
For any reason?
We did not do that. We asking if we did it, and we did not do it.
Yes,
the committee did not do that.
That's correct. Pass the witness.
Thank you. Mr. Bosa?
Your Honor, I'll just preserve my question to GBA's case in chief.
I will do the same as well.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Mrs. Blanc.
Am I done for the day, or do I need to?
No, you're done for the day.
Oh, thank you.
But I think Mr. Bosa did reserve his right to
call
her.
When he gets around to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just for a point of clarification, I don't think, I mean, as I understood from Mr. Rosano and Mr. Walsh, that they would take the rest of the afternoon for their witnesses. And so I don't expect Mrs. Bond to come back today. I would expect tomorrow morning, if that's the start of GPA's case, I would start with her or Mr. Bernadine. So.
You're going to recall her?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Not today.
Tomorrow.
Someday. The next witness.
Thank you, Mr. Public Auditor. We're calling Mr. Peter Rood for live testimony.
Please state your name for the record.
Peter Rood.
Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Public Auditor. Good morning, Mr. Wood. I'm going to call you Peter. You and I, is that okay?
Yeah.
Peter, just for the record, I'm again Joshua Walsh, one of the attorneys working with Glycop. Can you say, repeat your name and tell me what your position is and who you work for?
Sure. My name is Peter Rood. I'm the Chief Development Officer for Glycop.
Now, I'm going to ask you to look at that binder, the second volume. There's a date stamp, Exhibit 9, a bunch of zeros and an 8. So 90008. Can you tell me what that is?
Yeah, it's my resume from the technical proposal.
So, I mean, it's a resume that's, I guess, over a year old.
Yeah.
Right? But this is the resume you submitted?
Yeah, that's right.
We may come back to that, but you put the binder aside. More broadly, I want to know Glycop. What kind of work do they do? What kind of projects do they work on?
Yeah, so we are a independent power producer that develops, builds, and operates low carbon power facilities, mostly wind, solar, and energy storage.
Where does Glycop have projects?
So all our projects are in the United States. We have a number of projects in the mainland, and then we own and operate the Dan Dan facility here in Guam.
When did you start operating that facility?
We purchased that project from Energy Energy about a year ago.
And I would want to be clear about that. Did you develop and build that facility?
No, we're the third owner of the facility.
And how did that come about?
So the project was originally, as I understand, originally developed by two different developers that won a similar process. The phase one renewable procurement by GPA were awarded power purchase contracts. Energy purchased those from those other developers, combined them into a single project. Eventually, Energy built it, operated it for a few years, and then sold it to us.
Did Glycop's operation, I understand you didn't build it, but does Glycop's operations of the Dan Dan facility help shape its bid or its knowledge for its bid as we went into this phase three?
Yeah, I mean, our operations of the facility here, as well as the inherent kind of inherited lessons learned from Energy and their development and construction of it, informed all aspects of our bid, yeah.
And just to be clear, that's specific information about Guam?
Yeah. we learned a lot about operating solar at solar facilities here in Guam, and we inherited a lot of information from NRG as part of the transaction.
As you saw, because you were in the room, we are having a discussion about bid processes and what bid language means. I'd like to explore GlidePath's process in dealing with IFPs such as this. So could you first tell me who is involved in responding to this bid? I'm assuming it's not just you, but who actually works on these things?
Right, so it's a large team, for especially a bid like this one that's as detailed as this one was. So it includes everyone from myself and our staff developers, our internal engineering folks from this, because this project's on the Navy property, included folks from our federal group, finance, accounting, legal, so a large internal team, and then we hire subject matter experts to assist us with things like environmental reviews, detailed engineering. We work with vendors on procurement. It's a the large team of folks, both internal to GlidePath as well as internal.
Who is that outside vendor that you use to help with this particular bid project?
So you mean engineer?
Yes.
Yeah, so we use a firm called Mott MacDonald.
Now, I only know who Mott MacDonald is because I Googled him when I started working on this case. Could you help us understand who is Mott MacDonald?
Yeah, so Mott MacDonald is a large global kind of engineering consulting firm. They do work for owners. They do work for us. They do work for NRG. They do work for all numerous owners.
How did this bid tender process that you went through at GlidePath compare to the other tenders you've worked on?
It's a very complex process. As everyone knows, these documents are the bid documents themselves are, the IFB documents themselves are very detailed and kind of changed over time as various amendments were issued. And then the bids, the bid submission requirements, were on the more detailed end of what other buyers often ask for. There's a lot of technical information that was required to be submitted ahead of the bid, and we submitted all that, but this was a fairly detailed bid, especially when compared to a typical process on the mainline.
Peter, you involve engineers in this process of making
yeah.
the bids? I want to be clear, you are not an engineer.
No, I'm not an engineer.
Okay. But why are you the development chief if you're not an engineer? I mean, what role do you play in this bid process?
Yeah, so my focus and background is the commercial side of renewable power plants, how to get them from nothing to something, how to finance them, how to put all the pieces together and make them into successful little businesses. Each of these projects is a little business, and my job is essentially to oversee that business of the project. And that involves, recording with various experts as needed, like any other business would.
You work with GPA personnel on the Dandan site?
Yeah, GPA is our largest customer on that, or on Guam.
GPA have any issues with the way you were operating the Dandan site?
Not that I understand. In fact, we stepped into Dandan, it wasn't in great shape. The project, in fact, was just a few months away from insolvency. So we stepped in, not only purchased the project, injected a significant amount of additional cash to keep the project from going out of business, and then invested in essentially repairing the project back to its original configuration. If you look at the production numbers, which are GPA reports on a regular basis, the production in the last year has come up substantially from where it was previous, and that's a direct result of our work on the project. We're working to solve additional problems that GPA then involved.
I know that you worked with Mott MacDonald on some aspects of this. You have internal engineers?
Yeah, we have a team of internal engineers.
Can I get some names?
Yeah, so we have Sean Bauer, who's our kind of lead design engineer. He works significantly on this project. And then we have some engineers that are on our operating side as well.
Can I ask you to look at that binder, flip over to 900018? Yep. Is what is that?
That's Sean Bauer's resume from the bid from a year ago.
I want to talk about this particular phase three bid. A real simple question. The price is submitted. Did GlidePath submit the lowest price bid?
We did not, no.
You did submit the lowest price bid. You're not an awardee. Why are you all protesting?
Our protest really stems from the fact that we very kind of dutifully followed all of the IFB requirements. adjusted our project as the different amendments were issued and submitted what we know is a fully compliant bid. And you know, our purpose is because when you know the winner was ultimately announced and we came to understand about, more about their project, we realized they didn't follow all of the bid requirements. And so we think it's unfair that because we followed all the requirements, we were not selected because a party who did not follow the requirements was able to get a lower price because they didn't follow the requirements.
I want to make sure I'm absolutely clear that one of the key requirements that I understand at issue here is this idea that you, GP, on that chart submit installed 20.6 megawatts of panel on the site, and ANGI, the awardee, installed 26.7 megawatts on the site.
Yeah, I mean, our belief is that's why the price is lower, and that is in our that it is not compliant.
I don't think there's a dispute over the 26.47, but I just want to be clear. How do you know that ANGI put more than 20.6 megawatts on each of the sites?
We know today, because as part of this process, the procurement record has been made available, and we've looked at the ANGI bid. We submitted our protest, we knew, because ANGI made a public announcement that they had put about 50 megawatt peak on their sites, and that's more than 40, so that was clear it was in violation.
Okay, now, I guess my question is, so what? I mean, what difference does it make to the system putting 20.6 megawatts of installed PV arrays versus 27? What's the big rub here?
Yeah, so... As Ms. Vaughn mentioned, the product for these projects is kilowatt hours. So we sell to GPA our kilowatt hours of energy. So that's what you get paid for. The basic math for how these things work is that because GPA is really the only customer for these projects, it's not like there's several people that can buy energy. The sole customer is GPA. And and the project has a defined life, and so the owner of the project has to realize all of their revenue from GPA. So they have to get their costs back. Both the cost to build the project, the cost to operate it, as well as whatever profit and whatever else they need to get back, the cost to finance other stuff. They have to get all those costs back from the transaction.
And to be clear, you're getting the cost back from GPA. I mean, that ultimately goes to the rate payer.
Yeah, and the GPA then passes those through and collects them from their rate base. And so, yeah, so basically the project owner has to recover all of their costs and whatever profit, whatever else they need to get to make the project work for them through those sales of electricity. And they're very complex, very detailed models that ultimately allow the owners of a project to determine their price they need to do that. But essentially it comes down to adding up all those costs and dividing it by the total number of kilowatt hours the project will produce. And that then leads to the price per kilowatt hour you need to get from the utility to get the amount of money you want to make for the project in exchange for the project. In this case, the amount of solar generation capability that's installed on the site has a direct relationship to how much solar energy the project can make. Which therefore is the denominator in that equation. It kind of tells you how many kilowatt hours you have to earn back the money needed for the project. And so, why this particular issue is so important and so concerning to us is that because the IFB had a strict limit on how much solar generation capacity you could install, it was limited how many kilowatt hours you could produce to earn back all of that revenue, or all that money. And so, because we followed the bid requirements and had a 20.6 megawatt peak site, we were able to generate a certain amount of energy. And because NG didn't follow the bid requirements and put more than was allowed on the site, they were therefore able to generate more electricity and could, even if our projects were similar in cost, they were able to recover that cost over far more kilowatt hours, and therefore could present a much lower per kilowatt hour price to GPA. And because GPA was making their determinations on that kilowatt hour price, that lower price that allowed them to win.
I want to make sure we understand the basics of solar. So I've got a couple of just demonstrative aids to save us the time from drawing. I'm going to walk around, Mr. Public Auditor, if it's okay, make sure everyone's got a printed copies. So, if I can ask you to look at these aids at page one, I mean, this is sort of how a sunbeam becomes an electricity diagram. I mean,
yeah.
Could you walk me through that?
Yeah, so there's, I mean, basically the solar modules, solar panels convert sunlight into electricity, direct current electricity. The manufacturers of the solar panels, they're using kind of international standards, will rate a panel or module based on how much energy it can make, so that's the rating of that panel. And what happens then is you take those panels and you put them on a site. They usually don't make their rated power, they usually make some subset of it based on the angle of the sun and some other environmental characteristics. I don't think it's all necessary for this event, but the biggest influence is the amount of sunlight that reaches the solar module. In most cases, the lower the sun is in the horizon, the less energy is made, and the higher it is, the more.
That's why the two suns on the diagram.
Yeah, so here the lighter yellow sun, gets one lightning bolt, it's low, and the higher orange sun gets three lightning bolts, that's higher.
And these panels, there is a difference in price. You bid, the price you submitted was higher than the price Angie submitted. We acknowledge that. Is that price difference attributable to the fact, perhaps, would there be a price difference attributed to the fact that there's more panels on the site? I mean, they put more panels on the site. Why is it their price higher?
I don't know NG's solar pricing, but solar modules are generally a commodity item. There's not a lot of price variation, especially here because the panels were further restricted because they were required to comply with the Buy American Act. So there's not a lot to choose from. I'm sure the NG gets great pricing from their vendors, but these projects, this particular project, the solar panels are only a minor component of the overall price. The largest price component is the battery system and the balance of system, the cost to connect that battery system to the project, and that's the biggest piece of the project.
So we were talking earlier. You heard the conversation about DC coupling, AC coupling, DC.
Yeah.
Can you flip over to page two?
Sure.
This is a rough diagram, I suppose, of a solar project. This is the dam one.
Yep.
Can you walk me through this to understand how the power from the panels gets to the outlet powering the television that's behind you?
Sure. There's numerous solar panels. Our dam project has, I think, close to 100,000 solar panels. They're all connected together. Subsets of them are connected to each other and kind of build these blocks up together. A certain number of panels are connected to what's called an inverter. An inverter converts the DC, the direct current electricity that is generated from the solar panels, to alternating current, AC, which is what we use, what the grid operates at. And so what happens is the solar panel, the energy from solar panels are collected, they pass through an inverter, that inverter converts them to AC energy. There's a whole bunch of those kind of subsystems on the site, and the output from each of the inverters is collected more and more and more until you end up with essentially one connection to the utility, in this case GPA. That connection to the utility, where you connect to the utility's substation or station, is called the point of interconnection. That's where the ownership of the electron is transferred from the power plant owner to the utility. There's a meter there, just like you have a meter on your house, that counts the number of the kilowatt hours that go through, and that essentially is what you get paid on. And then from there, it's connected and intermingled with the rest of the power that the utility has and distributed to its customers.
Now, the phase three project differs from the earlier project that GPD had. If you go to page three of this aid.
Yeah.
What's the difference? I mean, what are we adding here in the rough scheme of things?
Yeah, so at Dandan, the instant the solar energy is generated from the solar panels, it's passed through all this stuff right into GPA. So, probably some of the electrons we're using right now are being generated by Dandan, and they're all generated, very, very, almost instantaneously, they're transferred. That's great because you do need electricity during the daytime when it's sunny out. GPA has Dandan. They have a bunch of solar panels on homes and businesses, the net metering program. They contracted for additional solar from as part of phase two. And what phase three kind of came to was that the GPA couldn't use all of the energy from the phase three projects during the day when it was actually generated, and needed to shift it to the evening hours when there's less sunlight and more electricity demand. And so the phase three project incorporated a significant amount of energy storage. And so it's very similar to the Dandan project in some ways, in that you have solar panels that are all connected to one another. Those solar panels then, instead of passing directly to the inverter and on the GPA, they first pass through a device called a DC to DC converter. And then from the DC to DC converter, the power is stored in batteries and until it's needed. And then when the power is needed, it's released from those batteries and onto the system.
I'm assuming when it's needed, you mean like at 6 p.m. when I'm watching Netflix?
Yeah, so when GPA dispatches the batteries, right.
Why, if the inverter's getting power in as a DC from the battery containers, why is there a DC converter coming from the panels if it's all DC on that side of the house?
Yeah, so the DC to DC converter essentially allows the two systems, the solar system and the energy storage system, to talk to each other. The voltages are different most of the time, and it would be difficult technically to connect the two without having that DC to DC converter. So even though it's still DC, the DC to DC converter adjusts the solar panel output to match what can be then fed into the energy storage system.
Did you go to page 4?
Yeah.
So, what's the difference between what I'm looking at on 3 and what I'm looking at on 4?
So, Glidepath's and NG's projects are essentially the same, for most of it. It's just that NG's projects have more solar panels feeding energy into the battery system. So they end up with more energy in the batteries and therefore can deliver more energy to GPA at nighttime when the GPA wants it.
But again, a sort of so what question. If GPA is expecting everybody here to have, everybody submitted 30 watt batteries, what difference does it make? If the batteries were 30, what difference does it make how many panels are on the other side?
Because the batteries themselves can't generate any energy. They just store it, right? And so the amount of energy the projects are able to deliver to GPA has to do with how much energy is in the batteries to start with. And because NG has more solar panels, they're able to generate more energy all the time. So when the sun is low in the horizon and the projects are just generating a little bit of energy, they have more modules generating that little bit of energy and therefore end up with more energy when it's all combined.
Did you recall Anji's council's sort of analogy of a tank being filled?
Yeah.
Is it fair to understand, just taking that analogy, that they've got a bigger hose filling the tank faster?
Yeah, the tank analogies are kind of hard with that, with the storage. It's,
why?
It's not the same thing. It's hard to represent in that analogy the difference in the amount of energy that each individual module is making. That's the key here, is that you have more modules that operate at partial power, so you end up with more energy. That's the problem.
Did your team know that putting more panels on the site would have an economy of scale advantage on price?
Yes, yeah.
Then why did Glidepath limit its install capacity to 20.7 megawatts?
Because as we understood it, there were requirements in the IFB, and in order to submit a project that could be selected, you had to meet other requirements.
I'm going to ask you to open up that binder, Exhibit 2, Volume 1, I think it's 2, and go to what's based on 2000160. We were talking about this earlier.
Sorry, 160?
160. How did you get a 20.7 cap system from this page, this amendment?
Yeah, so this amendment has a number of additional requirements that were added to the IFB And the 20.6 requirement, or the 20.7 ends up being, this requirement is derived essentially from the second last bullet on this page.
Which tells us what?
So this says that the megawatt rating of the solar system needs to be at least 145% larger than the solar system. So the solar part of the project, the GPA is limited to project size to 30 megawatts, that sets the size of the ESS, that's the maximum size of the ESS. So if you do the backwards math, that means in order to have, like as Joe said here, in order to get to exactly 30 megawatts, you need to have 20.7 solar. Maybe any more than 20.7 megawatts of solar installed, you end up with, as you see here, more than 30. And so that would not be a project that fit all the requirements.
I'm going to ask you to look at that introduction paragraph we spoke with Engineer Sablon about. And the last two sentences of that introduction, can you make sure you read them to yourself? Refamiliarize yourself. And then,
sorry, for the record, can I have the page reference?
It's the same page, 2000160.
160.
The introduction at the top. Those last two sentences. Could you read those last two sentences of that introduction part, starting with bids received?
Yeah, it says bids received will be judged based on adherence to the criteria and performance requirements noted in this amendment. To a degree, a conflict may arise from this amendment and the bid document, the language in this amendment shall prevail.
Did your team see that language when you prepared your bid?
Yes.
Does GPA have different introductions for different clarifications or amendments that they issued during this procurement that meant different things to you?
Yeah, so there's a whole bunch of amendments here, and GPA would introduce them in various ways. And one thing that GPA did, they made very clear when an amendment was revising, I think they used the terms remove and replace when they wanted to change something. They used the words insert when they wanted to insert something new. And I don't think they ever used the, I don't think there was any removals here of the things wholesale. But those are kind of things that were very clear indicators that they were changing the IFB itself. And then they had hundreds at this point of Q&A, which provided various additional information on the existing requirements.
Peter, I'm going to ask you to answer this question. How do we know that 20.7 was a physical limit, as opposed to sort of a GPA saying something, I don't want more than 20.7 given to GPA at any time, or as Angie's counsel suggested in its opening statement, that there's a charging system issue. Why do we take the position that this is a physical limit on install?
Yeah, so there's two things. One is there's kind of numerous indicators going all the way back to some of the CCU and PUC activity before this bid was even opened or introduced that they were looking for a 40 megawatt procurement. 40 divided by 2 is 220s. Those are the first indicators of 20 megawatts. And then you go through the IFB document and there are numerous references to the capacity being 20 megawatts. We heard just a while ago about the nominal 20 megawatts. Those comments kind of continued through these later stage amendments. All kind of clear signposts. This was GPA intended to procure 20 megawatts of renewable generation capacity, but then went into a battery that could be capable of dispatching up to 30 megawatts of that stored renewable energy capacity. That's kind of the one thing. If you work kind of the other way, I think we've thought about it. It doesn't make any sense that GPA would want a larger solar system that wasn't capable of putting all of the energy generated into the batteries and ultimately delivering that energy to GPA. As I mentioned before, the only customer for these projects is GPA. So in order for the project owner to recover all of the costs of the project, they have to get all that money from GPA and its ratepayers, through the sale of kilowatt hours. And so if GPA via its ratepayers is paying for a system that's capable of generating more than 20.7 megawatts, it doesn't make any sense to us that GPA would want to limit the amount of energy they got. Because they're already paying for the equipment. Why would they not want to get the energy that equipment they're paying for generates. It doesn't make any sense. So I think that, so that's why it was, it's very clear, you know, between those two things, it's very close to the physical limit.
Installed capacity.
Yes.
So there are a couple of terms that get thrown about in this IFB. I want to make sure I say them right. There's PV capacity, PV installation, PV charging system. To your understanding, GPA used all those terms interchangeably in this bid.
Yeah, everybody did.
Did, yeah, timing's important. Did you remember when this procurement first came out, the IFB?
Yeah, it came out in November of 2017, I think.
Do you remember when Amendment 13 came out?
I think January of 2019.
About a year later-ish.
Yeah, what a year, all over a year later.
Were there amendments issued by, or clarifications or answers issued by GPA after Amendment 13 that reconfirmed your understanding about this physical install limit and 20 megawatts on the site?
Yeah.
Can you turn the binder, go to the binder 2, exhibit 5, so base stamp 5, 00013. In these bid tenders, I'm sorry, I'll wait for you to get there. 500013. So, just a background question here. I know that certain offerers asked, the bidders, like you would ask questions and you would get answers. Did you review answers that were given to other bidders?
Yeah, we read everything. Several times.
You read everything?
Yes.
How many total hours of time do you think your team spent preparing this bid?
We spent, between us and our consultants, hundreds of hours working on this.
Do you see the answer to question number 30? We were talking with Engineer Savant about this earlier.
Yeah.
What about that answer reconfirmed to you and GlidePath that the Amendment 13 physical solar PV capacity limit is an actual physical limit?
Yes, this is another one of the numerous places that GPA describes the project as a 20 megawatt solar generating facility. So that means, in our mind, it's very clear that GPA intended that each of these projects would have 20 megawatts of solar generating capacity that would then be stored and later released. You know, and I think they're remarkably consistent about that throughout the documents.
When this came out, again, GlidePath still understood that putting more panels on the site would be a better thing for the ratepayer. Is that right? What was the last time you told that to GPA before bid submission? That more panels on the site would work?
Yeah, so we put it in our bid document. We said, as Mr. Vaughn read, we wanted to submit a fully compliant bid, and so we did everything that was asked of us in the documents. But then we're so, confident that there was a better deal for the people of Guam that we told GPA, hey, there's a better way to do this. You know, we think you ought to let everybody bid this better project, because we don't see the reason why they needed this limit. They can still achieve all their objectives, meet the requirements the Navy put forth with having, more generation capacity, which would give them a lower price.
Why didn't you just submit a bid that had more panels on the site?
Because we wanted to comply with the bid. I mean, the risk that we were weighing is that we wanted this project to move forward, and we wanted to make sure that our bid was fully compliant. Because, we assumed was that GPA would reevaluate these bids, would have a long checklist of the numerous requirements, they're scattered throughout the bid documents, and they would go through and the first thing they would do would check everything to make sure that every bidder complied with every requirement. And then those that complied, they would move forward, and then those would be bidding on the price part of it. So throughout this process, we move forward on that impression that everybody who had cleared the first step had gone through that rigorous evaluation of every requirement being checked.
I understand why you didn't exceed it, but you heard, and we've shown on the chart, that there's only one of these offerers who held to this 20.7 limit.
Right.
2106, 2358, 2497, 2647 Fumanji. Everybody exceeded it. Doesn't that just, I mean, couldn't you just construe that to me that you guys got it wrong? You're in error. You're the one guy in error. Everybody else got it right.
No.
Why not?
We follow the requirements.
But I thought I heard GPA testify earlier that they use step one to be a gatekeeper to make sure people make the technical requirements. So what does that lead you to conclude?
I think the challenging part with this bid is that it was extremely complex, there was lots of requirements. The requirements were not consolidated into a single list. It was you had to look through all of the documents and pick out the requirements that were scattered throughout. And then you had to, as a bidder, you had to then make sure all the bids, all those requirements were included in your bid. And, again, we thought that GPA had a list someplace of all, they had a consolidated list of all the requirements, and they would go through and check all of them before they did. And we thought that was the case all the way through. We realized that there was a better way of doing this. We told GPA that. And when they didn't take us up on the offer, we assumed that they wanted their system the way they wanted it, and that they were evaluating a number of bids that complied with all of the requirements.
You've had a chance to review the entire procurement record with your team?
We have, yeah.
Does it look to you like GPA didn't care about other bid specifications that were thrown out there during the procurement process?
Yeah, I mean, now we've had the opportunity to look at the entire procurement record. It is extremely frustrating that not only was this requirement not reviewed and consistently applied, there are other requirements, other major requirements that were not reviewed and consistently applied. And I think if it worked, it seemed like GPA put forth a number of requirements, some of which were extremely restrictive, and some of which significantly increased the cost to the ratepayers, and then ultimately didn't apply those requirements in their evaluation. So the question is, why did they have them to begin with? And it just seems like that it didn't lead the type of procurement we thought we were bidding into.
And that's fatal to a price analysis on step two of this. Why?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell if the people at Guam are getting the best deal for the project that was scoped out. I mean, if you have different people bidding different projects, just because one's less expensive, that's not what the bid was for. You can't use that to say then the whole thing is cheaper, because you don't know if that's the cheapest way to do that type of project.
If you were able to submit a bid that didn't hold to a 20.7 megawatt requirement, would your team analyze whether your price would be lower?
It would be significantly lower.
How long would it take you to prepare a rebid if you had to? Just adding the extra panels to the site.
Yeah, I mean, it would take us, to do all of the work required, not only to price it, but to create up all the supporting documents. It's probably a 6 to 8 week process.
Do you have a sense over the life of this project how much money leaves the GPA coffers as a result of this project? What's the value of this?
These are huge commitments by the people of Guam for these contracts. I mean, these are, I think it's roughly $100 million a piece over the course of 20 years. You're looking at $200 million total procurement across all of both of the projects that GPA is, over time paying the project owner.
Just briefly on remedies, because we have to address that in these procurement disputes. What does GlidePath want?
I mean, after looking at all the documents, it's clear that we're the only ones that complied with all the requirements. Now, I mean, that's kind of the game side of it, right? But I think, we want to be able to provide the project we originally told GPA we thought was the best project, which is the one that Ms. Savong read. And I think that's the project that we think meets the objectives and allows people at Guam to get the lowest priced power from this type of project.
Peter, I've got no other questions for you. Depending on the other questions, that I may have a redirect for you. But other than that, thank you for your time. I'll pass the witness to GPA.
Mr. O'Bea, how long would you like to go? I know we're turning on the lunch hour.
Let's try to see how, yeah.
Approach.
most of them are the same exhibits there, but just mine are a little bit more,
The table here a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Rude. How long have you been in the solar industry?
About 15 years.
And your experience on Guam, I assume you came to Guam when you were bidding on or purchasing the Dan Dan project?
Yeah, I first came to Guam during the phase one procurement process with a different employer. So I've been on Guam, familiar with the various renewable energy procurements through phase one, phase two, both times it was bid, and now with battery storage, or the battery original procurement that was done, and then now with phase three and I think my first trip was in Guam. Guam was in the late 2000s.
And would you agree that there's a significant amount of difference between the phase one NRG now project now owned by Glypath and phase three that we're bidding on?
I'm not sure I agree it's significant. The biggest difference is the addition of energy storage. They're still both photovoltaic generating facilities.
Okay. And are you aware of why GPA added battery storage and batteries to both phase two and phase three?
I am. My understanding is they were added for different reasons, but I understand that there were batteries added to both phases.
Okay. And would one of those, to your knowledge, be there's significant issues with unrestricted, I guess, or unmodulated solar output like the Glypath Phase 1 project?
I'm not sure I understand.
That there are frequency fluctuations, and as the sunlight passes or goes over the panels, energy or Glypath output can go from 25 megawatts down to a very low output. Is that correct?
I know GPA, there's kind of a couple of things that sounds like are baked into your question. The first is the frequency response or frequency management. Is that what you're asking about? That's different than the changes in power and output a little bit.
Well, difference in when the sun passes over, you can go from a 25 megawatt at the beginning of the day down to 4 or 5 megawatts. Is that correct?
I don't believe the delta between the two is that high, but I think what your question is getting at, which is accurate, is that as clouds pass over a solar project that does not have energy storage included, the output to the grid changes in relation to the amount of shading on the site. As you know, Dan Dan is subject to a ramping restriction that mitigates a lot of that in one direction, but does not in the other direction. That's because it's not including any battery storage.
And so this project is certainly different in the fact that not only, like the phase two thing, does it include battery storage, but this, would you agree, is the first project that's been designed or developed for Guam that includes shifting, load shifting.
Yeah, I would agree this is the first project that GPA has put out for bid that includes load shifting.
And is that significantly different in designing or from phase one project to phase three?
It depends on the part of the project you're talking about. So the phase three project requires the integration of batteries into the project. In terms of relative, yeah. You're getting batteries, so that adds, that's a different design piece of the project that doesn't exist for Dan Dan.
Okay, when you're talking about the solar project, you're saying usually the more solar arrays or solar PV panels, the better, is that correct?
The more solar modules that are on the site, the more energy the project would probably generate.
Okay. Isn't it a fair assessment that all solar projects would oversize or add extra panels?
I'm not sure I follow that. The solar project has as many panels as it has.
Right. And is there a reason you had additional ones? In other words, if you have a certain guarantee that you must make, what happens over time with solar panels?
The panels degrade.
So unless you're going to replace them out halfway through, you'd add more at the beginning, and you would limit those to whatever output is desired by the customer.
No, because I mean every solar procurement I've seen allows the degradation. It's built in. This one included allows for that degradation as part of the contract. So that, you know, in this project, you put in, you know, the bid required the bidders to identify the production for every single year, and every bidder, you know, adjust the production every year, which I assume was driven by that, the degradation of the modules. And that's how the Danden PPA is set up as well.
Did GPA put any limits on the project as far as the output for each site?
Yes.
And what was that?
30 megawatts.
Okay, so that was not 20 megawatts for each site, that was 30 megawatts that could be exported to the system at each site.
That's right. Okay.
And do you have any understanding as to why that was a limitation?
I thought it is that I think what GPA said is they did a stability study or some sort of study of the capacity of the 34.5 system in that area, and that was how much it was able to handle without significant upgrades.
Okay, is there any limitation on the transmission lines? Or 34.5 transmission line?
What do you mean?
Is there any limitation as to the amount of capacity that the transmission line could hold for the 34.5 system?
I'm sorry, I still don't understand the question.
I'm sorry, is there any limitation for the 34.5 kilowatt transmission line as to the amount that can be exported?
I mean, GPA said the limit at the point of interconnection is 30 megawatts. And the point of interconnection is on the 34.5 system. So, I mean, I don't know, you know, they didn't give us a study.
So your understanding, or your testimony before was, as Mr. Walsh had asked you, the glide path limited to 20.7 megawatts because you understood that there was a physical limit on the solar panels, and you understood that there was a 20 megawatt contained in the bid documents. Is that accurate?
The statement you said that I don't think is accurate. We understood that there was a 30 megawatt limit at the point of interconnection for the total project size, and using the other requirements in the bid, that translates into a 20.7 megawatt limit on the amount of solar generation installed.
Okay, and in looking at the chart that Mr. Walsh was so kind to draw on, you are the only bidder that made that determination. Is that fair? Accurate statement?
We're the only bidder that followed the requirement, correct.
Okay. So, but you were also the only bidder that believed that that was the basis of the bid, the 20.6 or 20.7 megawatt limit.
I mean, first of all, I don't know what there was thought. They didn't, the solar sizes that were bid, we're the only ones that bid 20.7 or less. Having reviewed Engie's proposal, they did acknowledge there's a restriction.
But yours is the only restriction on the size of the solar panels for each set.
We are the only project that has less than 20.7 megawatts of solar generation capacity.
Where exactly, you can use either binder if you like, where exactly does it speak to the solar PV size? Where does the IB identify the size of the solar PV? Or is it, I think in your testimony, your backwards math as to how you calculate it? Where does it say that the project size is limited to 20.7 megawatt solar PV panel?
So what the IFB does is it limits the size of the ESS and establishes a minimum ratio between the size of the ESS and the size of the PV capacity. And that is contained in Amendment 13, this supplement to the technical specs in the second last bullet. That ratio is.
Okay, so it's based on a ratio that you understand the limit. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's based on the ratio described in that bullet, correct.
Now, elsewhere in the bullet, are there other things in that bullet as well?
Yeah, it gives two examples.
Okay. And if you would turn to, if you take the small binder, it would be Exhibit B, and top set of the page is page 11,000.
Yep.
Okay, so I believe, well, first Mr. Walsh asked you, I think, to describe the introduction, that, and I don't think there's any dispute on where the point of interconnection is and the limits on that, right?
Yeah, I don't think so.
So if you go down to paragraph 2, second paragraph, and if you could read that first part of the sentence there.
The bidder should one?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the bidder should target to maximize the amount of energy that can be delivered to the GPA system given the locations where the PV can be deployed in the bid document. And other parameters set herein.
Okay, and then if you go down further, i.e. the ESS should be capable of load shifting?
Yeah, it says i.e. the ESS should be capable of load shifting all of the expected energy produced by the PV generation to hours when there is less or no PV generation.
Okay, and the next one?
It is estimated that up to 40 megawatts of ESS output into the GPA system can be scheduled by GPA into the GPA system.
Okay, so what does that mean to you? I read that 40 megawatt of ESS output. How does that differ from the 20 megawatt of solar panels, and is this the output from the battery storage system?
My read of this is that it's the combined output of both projects at the same time in the GPA system.
Okay, so that's your interpretation. That 40 megawatt, you don't say that's ESS output for one project, but in your opinion, it relates to both projects.
I'm not sure. I think so. There's this single sentence is confusing, and there's questions later in the IFB that I think clarify that GPA will procure two separate systems that are 30 megawatts each.
Okay. Now, to be fair, the 30 megawatt, is that the 30 megawatt AC? What it finally comes through the inverter, as you on your nice picture. And that's to each site, and that's based on limitation, as you described earlier, for transmission or whatever reason. That's at the GPA point of interconnection. Is that correct?
I think the 30 megawatt restriction is used different ways, but I think if you look at all of the clarifications, it's clear that GPA meant it's both the limitation on the interconnection at the point of interconnection, but also the limitation on the size of the ESS.
And then the last sentence of that paragraph, the MW output of PV, what does that mean to you?
Yeah, so it says the megawatt output of PV used to charge the ESS should be maximized to the amount of capacity available on each site and any energy restrictions of the ESS.
Does that mean that you're going to maximize the battery storage part of the equation?
What that means to me is that I think there's a couple things in here. First off, is that I think it means that you have to take all the energy your installed PV system is capable of generating and put in the ESS, and then deliver that ESS or that energy to GPA.
Okay, but not all the energy will ever get to GPA. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I mean there are electrical losses at various points in the project.
Okay, and what would you say in order of magnitude is that? 5, 6, 7%?
I'm not sure. I know it's calculated in ours and for the bidder's document. That's on top of my head.
Okay. But there's a model that I guess calculates that.
Yeah, you can model it, right? Yeah, yeah.
So in other words, and then in your thing, I know your project spells out what's the difference between a nameplate rating and then the actual rating of the ESS or the panels or whatever else. They're not both the same, are they? Usually.
It depends. Different equipment used in different configurations have different ratings. I think when it comes to solar, They are the same, because the nameplate of the solar facility is just the summation of the nameplates of all the panels installed.
Okay, what about for battery storage system?
Well, a battery storage system itself doesn't really have a megawatt nameplate rating. It's a function of the inverter. The battery, like when you buy the battery and it shows up, there's not a real megawatt rating. I think there's an engineering answer, probably more complex, but the general understanding of this that I have is that the megawatt rating is really a function of the inverter that's attached to that battery system.
Along with the inverter, is there, I guess, if you will, a rating for what the output of the battery is? In other words, is there a megawatt hour or kilowatt hour for all the batteries summed together?
It's not an output, it's the storage capacity. So the maximum instantaneous output, which is measured in megawatts, and there's the overall storage capacity, the volume, which is measured in megawatt hours.
So for your battery storage system, there's a megawatt hour one, and that can be discharged over a certain period of hours. Is that accurate?
Not 100% sure I follow your question.
So in other words, there's a megawatt hour, I guess, capacity for the battery with the inverter system that's discharged into the grid, and then obviously you can do it for X number of hours. Is that a fair way of looking at it?
Yeah, so the system had, for example, a 1 megawatt power rating and a 10 megawatt hour battery capacity. If you were operating at 1 megawatt, you could operate, and the battery is full, you could operate for 10 hours.
Okay. If you could look at the last, I guess the second to the last bullet on the page, starting with the megawatt rating of the ESS.
Yep.
So, what does that mean to you? It says up to maximum capacity of 40 megawatts. Is that limited by anything else? Or is that, and that is relating to the ESS battery storage system?
Yeah, so I mean, so when you take this paragraph by itself, it says the max capacity is 40 megawatts. When you combine it with the other requirements, we know that even though this requirement seems to make it the maximum 40 megawatts, the overall system's kept at 30.
But I think you finished telling me 30 megawatt AC capacity is the output at the interconnection point. Surely there are different capacity restrictions and restraints on the battery storage system as well as the panels. Is that fair?
I'm not sure if there's, I'm not an engineer, so I'm not sure if there's a different megawatt constraint on the battery itself. I mean, typically when I've seen batteries described, it's a function of the inverter.
Okay, but this one does say, the ESS shall be equal to the same 145% of the megawatt rating of the PV charging system up to a maximum capacity of 40 megawatt. So standing alone, that particular one on the same page with all that important language that Mr. Walsh described would indicate that the ESS could have a maximum capacity of 40 megawatt. Is that correct?
I would read this as establishing a ratio. So, I mean, if one were to have a, you know, if the requirements were to allow for a 40 megawatt project, this ratio conceivably would allow you to have a 27 megawatt battery, as shown in the examples. And as I said before, the GPA had limited the projects to 30 megawatts each. So, even if you got 40,
they eliminated the AC part of the project to 30 megawatts each, but could you have a DC battery charging system of 40 megawatt as well?
Sorry, say that again?
I mean, this maximum capacity relates to the battery storage system, which has nothing to do with the AC output.
Nothing to do with the AC output. I'm not sure, but that answers more of an engineering question.
Okay.
Like you mentioned, my understanding is the batteries are measured.
Okay, So does it go on to provide two examples? And I think Mr. Walsh was at least kind enough to put one of them up on the page there. If you could read the next line, starting with, for instance, for a PV installation of 27 megawatts.
Yeah, for instance, for a PV installation of 27 megawatts, the ESS should be rated at a minimum of 40 megawatts.
And does that match that I guess rough math, 145% MW, 145% of the MB rating of the BB charging system. Is that rough math? Would that?
Yeah, because I've done it before, it is correct.
And then obviously the smaller one, 10 megawatt, that's just another example, and the math would come up to 14.5. That one's actually pretty accurate.
Yep.
Easy to do with zeros. What does the storage rating, the ASS, shall be 105% of the expected? What does that mean to you?
So I think this...
Does that account for losses, or, I mean, would that be your interpretation of that?
No, because I think this is talking about, I mean... Not clear in the statement, but I think the context here, this is talking about, now because of the use of the word production, it's talking about the volume capacity of the ESS, the, you know, how big, how many megawatt hours it can hold. Whereas the previous one was talking about kind of the instantaneous rating in megawatts. I think this other one is now talking about how much of the production, the daily energy production, which is measured in megawatt hours, could the battery hold. And so I think here is GPA setting an expectation about, you know, the fact that the ESS needs to be a sufficient capacity to hold the majority of the production on an average day.
Okay, with regard to the battery storage system, is it your understanding that the GPA was pointing out through several of the amendments and clarifications that the battery storage system needs to be an asymmetric product? In other words, it charges slower and discharges faster. Is that an accurate layman's term?
I've read that explanation in the Q&A provided by GPA.
Do you disagree with that, or do you agree, or is that too simple a term, or we need an engineer?
I mean, no, so that is what the established ratio is doing. It is reducing the size, it is making it so that the PV portion of the project is not capable of charging the battery above this ratio, essentially.
Okay, so you're saying that the solar part of the project would tie into how the battery operates as a limit?
No.
Okay, so how does it limit that?
What this ratio establishes is that the maximum amount of output in any given moment from the maximum amount of generation capacity of the PV system is set as a ratio to the maximum output of the project. And so what it's saying is that you have a 20 megawatt PV system that collects energy throughout the day, puts it into a battery, and then that battery dispatches for a shorter period of time. And so it sets the relationship of how much volume the project can produce. How much volume? Because like I mentioned before, the battery itself can't create energy. It can only store, it stores it. And so the creation of energy is coming from the solar system.
Okay, and if you could turn to exhibit A on the small book and page 11964 at the top. First page, fourth page of exhibit A.
Yes.
Okay, this was part of the original bid. I think you may have gone over it, but it's originally the fourth page after, or the first page after the three page thing on the
part of the bypass bid.
No, the original IFP.
Oh.
I think it's on your...
Oh, I got it.
Basically, it's the overview of the first page of the overview on the...
Oh, okay.
I should have brought two more copies.
964, the last three you
have? Yeah. 11964.
Give an extra copy. We base stamped our exhibits in our binder. You've got a base stamp equivalent to some of them. And you don't have a printed copy of your exhibits?
Hold on.
and or a projection on a screen of your exhibits?
Okay, how about we turn to base stamp 1-09?
No. I apologize. I just for the record, I think I understand my confusion. We've got a set of base stamp numbers from us, we've got a set of numbers from the procurement record, and we got a set of page numbers from the bid.
Yes.
So we are looking at.
So I just wanted to clarify for him that, at least on my small one,
it had the
page numbers from the procurement record on top. But anyways, let's go with this one.
It's 1-00052.
Thank you.
Page 52.
Yeah. And basically, the first or second page is 1 or 2 of 51.
52.
Okay, and so I think at the top, the overview and the. Would read, overview 1, paragraph 1, that starting with the bidders, renewable resource projects will have a maximum export capacity, 30 megawatts.
Yeah, the bidders, renewable resource projects will have a maximum export capacity, 30 megawatts AC at the interconnection point. This may be a combination of several generation units on one site.
Okay, so notwithstanding what GPA may have estimated as 20 megawatts each site, it was very clear that the maximum that we could take from each site was 30 megawatts.
Yeah, I mean, this is the total project size at the point of interconnection.
And then looking down to paragraph 5, the primary purpose of the ESS will be for energy shifting, which is deliver the solar produced energy at another time of day. And so is that what the I guess as other stated further in the amendments, that was the purpose of the battery storage system, to charge during the day and then release it, I guess, originally it was 6 to 10 p.m., and then, as I understand from the amendments, it went to 5 to midnight. Is that accurate?
The first part of that is accurate. I'd have to refresh my memory on the timing, but yeah, the first part of your statement of the purpose of the project was to collect the solar energy generated during the day, store it in the storage system for it to be released later at night. Okay.
What would happen? I mean, let's say your battery storage system is fixed what was the size of the glide path battery storage system?
30 megawatts.
30 megawatts. And then how many megawatt hours did that last?
I have to double check with our numbers, but it was I think at least 4 hours. I don't have to top up that
much. Okay, so 4 hours roughly. So what would happen?
So I agree with that. I'm not sure. It met the requirements of this version. I just don't have the top of that.
Oh, got it. Okay, so whatever was requirements was, your understanding met exactly for that one. What happens if you would have more panels and keep the same size battery? What happens to that?
Modules, we would fill the battery up more often. So these projects, both you know, these projects, the battery doesn't get filled up every day. Some days it doesn't quite get filled up. Some days it gets filled up more. So by having more batteries, we'd be able to put more of that energy into the production. And going back to the requirement you had me read the other before, which is the 105%.
Right.
So that's based off the average daily production. So the production is based on the amount of panels that you have, and the GPA had a requirement that adjusted the production, adjusted the battery size to ensure your battery is always big enough to capture all the production on most days. So I think that you can't, I mean, in this, what you're trying to illustrate, you have to redesign the whole project if we had more panels. It wouldn't make sense and we wouldn't be compliant with the bid if you just took the same system that we previously proposed and add more panels. You have to adjust more of the system. Because there's a number of requirements that interact with one another.
Okay, but I mean, you would run some sort of program to optimize the size of the battery as well, right?
Yes.
I assume that's what your program does.
Yeah, so we would take the production estimate based on the new number of panels, figure out the average daily production, you know, in different scenarios, and then size our battery to capture that energy in compliance with the IFB, and frankly, just to make sure we got it all to deliver to GPA.
If you would turn to page 1-56. And specifically the paragraph 2.3.1 on minimum and maximum project capacity. So what does the no minimum nameplate project capacity that Bitter Bay offer? What does that mean to you?
So you said
2.3.1. Yes. If you could read that one.
Yeah, so I think it just says that this requirement that there's no minimum project size, only a maximum project size.
Okay, so does that speak anywhere as to the number of panels or plus or minus that you need or limited to?
I mean, it talks about the overall project size, so I guess indirectly it does, but it doesn't say that directly.
Okay, so on that one, basically it just says there's no minimum. Obviously, I would argue that the smaller the project you put in, the much less chance you'd have, as you said, to cover your costs.
That's correct.
And therefore, the smaller project would fail because the cost would be so high.
Generally. I mean, the only thing to note here is that this is part of the technical amendment. So these requirements that you're having to read are subject to change by the supplement, right? Because that superseded all of these. So you have, I mean, I think this is, you know, what GlideFed did in preparing its bid is went through and we did all this reconciliation between the two. You can't really read these by themselves without referencing the...
All the rest of the amendments.
Yes.
Okay. So
this is
on
the first documents in this.
Right, and I think you've indicated that you've gone over all of the amendments as well as the questions, whether they were put forth by GlidePath or KEPCO or Angie for that matter. So do you believe, however, that this particular one has been changed in any form, to your knowledge, by any of the rest of the amendments?
I'm not clear we're trying to get at, which is probably the point, but I think if you were to have a, you know, yeah, so I think you'd have to have you're trying to have a battery, but like, I mean, I'm not sure you're trying to get, like, you're saying you have a battery that's below a minimum size. I mean, I'm not.
Well, no, I guess.
This wouldn't prevent a bidder from, I don't think, I don't look at all the requirements. I don't know if GPA eventually put in a minimum project size or not. But if they didn't, then I mean, I guess you could put in a 5-megawatt project or a 1-megawatt project and meet this specific requirement because there's no minimum.
Okay, and here there's also nothing that speaks to the size of the solar PV arrays or the battery storage system for that matter either.
That's right. A lot of those requirements were added in the. This paragraph does not speak to those things. I need to read the entire IFB to answer that question thoroughly, but a lot of the requirements that we're talking about today were added in Amendment 13, which changed this thing. So yeah, I'm not sure if there's any requirements or not. It's hard to tell off the top of my head.
Okay, let's see if we can match up with your other stuff too. During the peak time, maybe 10 to 2 o'clock, the solar PV output, you know, produces more power than is needed to charge your particular battery system, in your case, the 30-megawatt system, what happens to it then? Is it just the battery, I mean, the power just goes away, or it's just not as efficient as it could be?
What do you mean if it's not available? So in our system, the, you know, if the solar portion of the project is operating at its full installed capacity, assuming there's space in the battery, which, I, you know, like I said, our battery size, we do a lot of work making sure we size the battery correctly. On an average day, there'd be space in the battery, so all the energy would be stored in the battery.
Okay, and so 6 in the morning is really not much solar output. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah.
Based on your operation. And the 6 at night, and pretty much zero to that accurate.
Right, yeah, I mean, you're talking about pure output from a solar panel?
Right. So all of your panels, even just looking at your phase one project. So would you agree that the peak is probably somewhere between 10 and 2 produce the most power?
At day and end, certainly that's
okay, day and end, right. And so clearly it charges the battery at a faster rate during that period of time. Does
yes.
that mean it just fills it up faster, or
yeah.
or? I mean, if you added more panels, what would it do? Just fill it up even faster at that
That's
particular
right.
time?
Yeah.
But still, no matter how many panels you added, probably at 400
I'm sorry. I answer these questions assuming that you would make an engineer now and adjust the rest of the project accordingly. You can't just wire up panels onto a solar project that's already been designed for one. You can go to Dan and start adding panels to it. You need to make other engineering changes to the project to make it function correctly. Does that make sense?
Okay. If you would turn to your big book since
probably 2
volume 2.
Okay, 5-13. So I think Mr. Walsh asked you about question 30. I'm going to ask you about question 32. Does that one look familiar to you?
Yep.
Okay. And I think that's the same one. If you just read through the whole thing in the answer.
You want to read out loud, or?
I'm sorry, starting with question 32, talking reference amendments.
Go ahead, read it out loud, or something, read it myself.
I do first, and then you can read it out loud after you have a chance to look.
Okay. So the question is, and there's a document reference to amendment 13, page 160 out of 948. And the question is, the megawatt rating of the ESS, well, they said it recites the requirement. And then the second question, or then it says, can we therefore assume the maximum PV charging system rating can be installed can be 27 megawatts?
Okay, and the answer is?
So the answer to the question, can the PV charging system be 27 megawatts? The answer is, this section of the amendment is to illustrate that the charging and discharging times of the ESS are different, and design of the ESS should include consideration that the ESS would only have 4 to 6 hours to discharge at a maximum interconnection output of 30 megawatts AC. I think it's the end of it.
Okay. So that's another example that indicates the 40 megawatt, but I think your position is that and the 27 megawatts described doesn't match up with the other restrictions in a bit.
Well, I mean, this specific question is asking is the project size maximum 27 megawatts, and GPA doesn't answer that question, and they don't confirm it. So I'm not sure who asked this question, but it certainly doesn't seem to mean that a project could be 27 megawatts.
Okay, except for the other question that shows the example up to a maximum capacity of 40 megawatts, right?
Objection. Just to be clear, that's not a question. That's a question reciting Amendment 13 language from GBA. So Angie's not asking that question. It's just saying, with reference to the answer that was given in Amendment 13, we have a question. The question is, can we put 27 on the site? So just to be clear, that's not two questions. There's one question referencing the earlier answer from Amendment 13.
Okay. Let's come back to your position is that based on the language in the bid and the amendments and all the rest of everything, that there was a physical restriction on the size of the solar PV.
That's right.
And out of the five bidders, you would agree you were the only one that had that impression.
I would say that we were the only ones that complied with the requirement, yes. Mm-hmm.
And you were the only, I think your testimony was, is you were the only one offer that held to that 20.7 megawatt limit on the solar panel arrays.
Yeah, for the only ones that complied with the requirement.
Looking at price, would you agree that your price was substantially higher than the price offered by Engie?
I would say that our price is not comparable to the price offered by Engie because they're different projects.
Okay, on a strict price per kilowatt hour, is your price different from Engie?
Yeah, and the two prices are different. That's right.
Okay. And yours is substantially higher.
Objection, yeah. That was asked and answered, and the answer was the systems are not comparable. So asking the question again after he says it's not comparable to simply prove that the numbers are different. We opened up with the idea that the numbers are different. We acknowledge that. We don't need to spend repeated time saying the numbers are different. That's my objection. It's been asked and answered.
I understand.
Thank you, Mr. Tobler.
Okay, you had a lengthy discussion about the value to the rate payers.
That's right.
Does low price mean anything to you as a rate payer?
Yeah, I mean, I think the purpose of these procurements is to establish a set of requirements, collect bids that meet all of those requirements, and then of the bidders that meet all the requirements, choose the one that has the lowest price.
I don't think you answered the question. Does low price mean anything to you as a rate payer individual?
Yeah, I mean, the utility is conducting the procurement as I described, then you'll be getting the low price of the power you're buying, I guess.
I don't have any further questions, Mr. Rupien.
Okay. Why don't we break? Come back at 2:30.
2:30.
All right. And we'll go until we finish him and whoever comes after him. Okay. So just plan for being here late.
Okay.
Does
that mean we would finish the only thing I was asking, would we finish the Glycock witnesses today?
Obviously not.
May I ask a logistical question just so we clear about this? We have the Sergeant Lundy experts ready to tell a presence. Well, they were ready to tell a presence in, but they're in New Jersey, which has got a significant time difference. I think we're getting into 1 a.m. or something there already.
Not quite, but yeah, it'll be
after midnight. Just based on, if I could ask respectfully, if what the nature of the cross examination would be, are we going to expect a long cross examination for this witness so they can let those gentlemen go to bed so they can start bright and early with us tomorrow morning? Or is this going to be a very short examination? We're going to get right to these guys.
So then we will have a logistical problem, Mr. OPA, because obviously I've got a guy also in Alaska. There's a time zone problem, so I expect it to start Tuesday morning from my previous discussions with counsel. If that's not going to happen, then, I mean, I can call all my other witnesses. I'm more than happy to expeditiously figure that, but I kind of need a morning-ish block for that particular one. So if it's delayed, it's delayed.
Well, we're also trying with, because of the telepresence nature, working with counsel on just going out of order if need be to get the witness testimonies on, if you've got somebody booked. But I just wanted some
input on the whether or not we think that the Pelley's are going to be done with Mr. Rood, and that
today?
And that we should be expecting to try to get our
East
Coast
we'll experts. Done with today.
And who's your next witness?
It would be one of the gentlemen from Sergeant Lundy, our third-party engineers.
And who would that be, Mr. Mayon or Mr. Charles?
Well, now that we know that we can, we have both of them, we were going to discuss that at the break with them to figure out who would go first.
Do you have any other witnesses you can call instead of these two guys?
For today?
Are there any local witnesses, perhaps?
Perhaps somebody in rebuttal, but... to be honest, I expected...
Well, I think we need to talk about whether we're going to bring anyone else from GPA based on
yes.
Lon's answers, too. So, but we don't have 19 witnesses.
We were expecting a longer...
We have about three witnesses, maybe a fourth.
We were expecting a longer series of direct examination questions from Ms. Sablon. Once we called her here, we didn't know she was going to be called. That's one of the reasons we're moving faster than I thought we would. Just to be honest about that, please.
So the lineup is going to be after Mr. Rood, one of the people from Sergeant Lundy.
Then the Sergeant and Lundy, and then I think that's our case in chief, other than perhaps a rebuttal or two.
Okay.
And right, I mean, I think the GPA will put somebody on, and we'll deal with GPA's witnesses then.
Okay.
So it's now 11 o'clock in New Jersey.
It is.
PM.
Yeah, 11 p.m.
Yeah. If we just finish him and we start with New Jersey in the morning, would that be okay?
I would like to get as much out of the way today as possible.
Yeah.
Could we get Alaska on this afternoon?
Well, no. You have to finish yours first.
Well, we would make the request then to spend the time with Mr. Rood to bring New Jersey on in the morning with our case.
We're going to wind up with these no matter what. We have witnesses that are in Milan, too. We've got to find dates, the times that are going to be perfect for everybody. That's not necessarily important.
Well, the public auditor understands our request on that.
And our concern is that, you know, we're going to be going into day two, day three. This is your case, but if you anticipated calling two different expert witnesses, they should be prepared to go on.
I don't think we anticipated the morning of motion arguments as well, but again, our case is pretty tight. We've got one witness here. We called GBA's witness in an effort to save time to get right to GBA's witness. The other parties didn't do a direct examination of her. That's fine. They want to reserve that to call, recall later. I understand that. So we have Mr. Rood, and we've got two other witnesses. I don't think it's unreasonable to say that these witnesses testifying.
I had planned for them to be, I looked at their 19, I figured we were going to be going all week. So to finish this and then end the day so that we could deal with the 10-hour difference. And I will try to be as accommodating to everybody as possible. Because it is what it is, actually, with us dealing with this. Okay?
Just the one minor before the break, I'm going to be, maybe now's not the time to do it, move all the sort of exhibits we've been referencing from the procurement record, decide it into evidence. I don't know if you want me to wait till later to do that, or do it at this first break. I don't anticipate any objections to that.
So my understanding is the procurement record is just put in different binders by different folks.
Yes.
I mean, it's all from the procurement record. The only additional, to my understanding, is the demonstrative evidence that were supplied by other party.
The chart that I went through with the Sablon.
Okay. I mean, that would be it.
Let's do 2:30, and then
okay.
We'll break. And have your person ready. Whatever hour that is, we'll start. Do you want to start tomorrow morning at 9 or 10?
As early as possible.
Let's start at 9 tomorrow morning.
Yeah,
okay?
So we will tell our Sergeant and Lundy folks to start at 9 o'clock tomorrow.
Yes, go on time.
Yes, of course.
Okay?
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Pogodaro.
We're off the record at 12:56 p.m.
Just leave all this stuff here.